Yes, Willie. No. You think that's going to stop me worrying?
There was a low, rueful chuckle in reply.
I shouldn't think so. No.
There was a brief silence before Brianna spoke again.
I just
keep thinking. What will I do if something does happen? If he doesn't come back? I'm all right during the day, but at night I can't help thinking.
Oh, well, he said softly.
I saw him tilt up his head to the stars, blazing overhead.
How many nights in 20 years, Aeneen? How many hours? For I spent that long in wondering whether my wife still lived, and how she fared. She and my child.
His hand ran smoothly over my head, gently stroking my hair. Brianna said nothing in reply, but made a small inarticulate sound in her throat.
That's what God is for. Worry doesn't help. Prayer does. Sometimes,
he added honestly.
Yes, she said, sounding uncertain. But if... And if she had not come back to me,
he interrupted firmly.
If you had not come, if I had never known, or if I'd known for sure that both of you were dead.
He turned his head to look at her, and I felt the shift of his body as he lifted his hand from my hair and reached out his other hand to touch her.
Then I would still have lived, Aeneen, and done what must be done. So will you.
Chapter 82. A Darkening Sky. Roger pushed his way through a thick growth of sweet gum and pin oak, sweating. He was close to water. He couldn't hear it yet, but could smell the sweet resinous scent of some plant that grew on stream banks. He didn't know what it was called, or even for sure which plant it was, but he recognised the scent. The strap of his pack caught on a twig, and he jerked it free, setting loose a flutter of yellow leaves like a small flight of butterflies. He would be glad to reach the stream, and not only for the sake of water, though he needed that. The nights were growing cold, but the days were still warm, and he had emptied his canteen before noon. More urgently than water, though, he needed open air. Down here in the bottomland, the stands of dogwood and sweet bay grew so thickly that he could barely see the sky, and where the sun poked through, thick grass sprang up knee-high, and the prickly leaves of dahoon caught him as he passed. He had brought Clarence the mule, as being better suited than the horses to the rough going in the wilderness, but some places were too rough even for a mule. He had left Clarence hobbled on the higher ground with his bedroll and saddlebags, while he thrashed his way through the brush to reach the next point for a survey reading. A wood duck burst from the brush at his feet, nearly stopping his heart with the drumming of its wings. He stood still, heart thumping in his ears, and a horde of vivid little parakeets came chattering through the trees, swooping down to look at him, friendly and curious. Then something unseen gave them alarm, and they rose up in a bright shriek of flight, arrowing away through the trees. It was hot. He took off his coat and tied the sleeves round his waist, then wiped his face with a shirt sleeve and resumed his shoving, the weight of the astrolabe swinging on a thong round his neck. From the top of a mountain he could look down on the misty hollows and wooded ridges and take a certain awed pleasure in the thought that he owned such a place. Down here, come to grips with wild vines, burrowing foxtails and thickets of bamboo-like cane higher than his head, the thought of ownership was ridiculous. How could something like this, this fucking swamp primeval, possibly be owned? Ownership aside, he wanted to finish with this jungle and get back to higher ground. Even dwarfed by the gigantic trees of the virgin forest, a man could breathe in the space beneath. The limbs of the giant tulip trees and chestnuts stretched in a canopy overhead that shaded the ground beneath, so that only small things grew beneath, mats of delicate wildflowers, ladies' slippers, trilliums. And the trees' dead leaves rained down in such profusion that one's feet sank inches into the springy mat. Incomprehensible that such a place should ever alter. And yet it did. It would. He knew that fine. Knew it. Better than knew it. He'd bloody seen it. He'd driven a car down a paved highway, straight through the heart of a place once like this. He knew it could be changed. And yet, as he struggled through the growth of sumac and partridgeberry, he knew even better that this place could swallow him without a second's hesitation. Still, there was something about the sheer awful scale of the wilderness that soothed him. Among the gigantic trees and teeming wildlife, he'd found some peace. Peace from the dammed-up words inside his head, from the unspoken worry in Brianna's eyes, the judgment in Jamie's, judgment withheld, but hanging there like the sword of Damocles. Peace from the glances of pity or curiosity, from the constant, slow, aching effort of speech. Peace from the memory of singing. He missed them all, especially Bree and Jem. He seldom dreamed with any coherence, not like Bree. What was she writing now in her book? But he had wakened this morning from a vivid impression of Jem crawling over him as he liked to do, poking and prodding inquisitively, then softly patting Roger's face, exploring eyes and ears, nose and mouth, as though searching for the missing words. He hadn't spoken at all for the first few days of surveying, terribly relieved not to have to. Now he was beginning to talk again, though disliking the hoarse, mangled sounds of the words, but not so bothered, since there was no one else to hear. He heard the gurgle then of water over stones and burst through a screen of willow saplings to find the stream at his feet, sun sparking off the water. He knelt and drank and splashed his face, then chose the spots along the bank from which to take his sightings. He dug the ledger book, ink and quill from the leather bag over his shoulder and fished the astrolabe out of his shirt. He had a song in his head. Again. They sneaked in when he wasn't looking, melodies singing in his inner ear like sirens from the rocks, ready to dash him in pieces. Not this one, though. He smiled to himself as he nudged the bar of the astrolabe and sighted on a tree on the opposite bank. It was a children's song, one of the counting songs Bree sang to Jemmy. One of those terrible songs that got into one's head and wouldn't get out again. As he took his sightings and made the notations in his book, he chanted under his breath, ignoring the cracked distortion of the sounds. The ants go marching one by one. 5,000 acres. What in hell was he to do with it? What in hell was he to do? Period. Down to the ground to get out of the rain. Bum, bum, bum. I discovered quickly why my name had appeared to have significance to Tsatsawi. The name of the village was Raventown. I didn't see any ravens as we rode in, but did hear one calling hoarsely from the trees. The village lay in a charming location, a narrow river valley at the foot of a smallish mountain. The town itself was surrounded by a small spread of fields and orchards. A middling stream ran past it, dropping down a small cataract and flowing off down the valley into what looked from a distance like a huge thicket of bamboo. A canebrake, it was called. The leafy giant canes glowing dusky gold in the sun of early afternoon. We were greeted with cordial enthusiasm by the residents of the town, lavishly fed and entertained for a day and a night. In the afternoon of the second day, we were invited to join in what I gathered was a petition to whichever Cherokee deity was in charge of hunting, to invoke favour and protection for the expedition against the ghost bear that was to take place next day. It hadn't occurred to me, prior to meeting Jackson Jolly, that there might be as much variance in talent among Indian shaman as there was among the Christian clergy. I had by this time encountered several of both species, but buffered by the mysteries of language, hadn't previously realised that a calling as shaman didn't necessarily guarantee a person the possession of personal magnetism, spiritual power, or a gift for preaching. Watching a slow glaze spread across the features of the people packed into Peter Bewley's wife's father's house, I realize now that whatever his personal charm or connections with the spirit world, Jackson Jolly was sadly lacking in the last of these talents. I had noticed a certain look of resignation on the faces of some of the congregation as the shaman took his place before the hearth, clad in a shawl-like blanket of red flannel, and wearing a mask carved in the semblance of a bird's face. As he began to speak, in a loud droning voice, the woman next to me shifted her weight heavily from one leg to the other and sighed. The sighing was contagious, but it wasn't as bad as the yawning. Within minutes, half the people around me were gaping, eyes watering like fountains. My own jaw muscles ached from being clenched, and I saw Jamie blinking like an owl. Jolly was undoubtedly a sincere shaman. He also appeared to be a boring one. The only person who appeared riveted by his petitions was Jemmy, who perched in Brianna's arms, mouth hanging open in awe. The chant for bear hunting was a fairly monotonous one, featuring endless repetitions of Hey, hey, ya, ya, hanewa, hey, ya, ya, hanewa, hey, ya, ya, hanewa. Then slight variations on the theme, each verse ending up with a rousing and rather startling Yo-ho! As though we were all about to set sail on the Spanish Main with a bottle of rum. The congregation exhibited more enthusiasm during this song, though, and it finally dawned on me that what was wrong was probably not with the shaman himself. The ghost bear had been plaguing the village for months, so they must have gone through this particular ceremony several times already, with no success. No, it wasn't that Jackson Jolly was a poor preacher, only that his congregation was suffering a lack of faith. After the conclusion of the song, Jolly stamped fiercely on the hearth as punctuation to something he was saying, then took a sage wand from his pouch, thrust it into the fire, and began to march round the room, waving the smoke over the congregation. The crowd parted politely as he marched up to Jamie and circled him and the Beardsley twins several times, chanting and perfuming them with wafts of fragrant smoke. Jemmy thought this intensely funny. So did his mother, who was standing on my other side, vibrating with suppressed giggling. Jamie stood tall and straight, looking extremely dignified, as Jolly, who was quite short, hopped around him like a toad, lifting the tail of his coat to perfume his backside. I didn't dare catch Brianna's eye. This phase of the ceremony complete, Jolly regained his position by the fire and began to sing again. The woman next to me shut her eyes and grimaced slightly. My back was beginning to ache. At long last, the shaman concluded his proceedings with a shout. He then retired into the offing and took off his mask, wiping the sweat of righteous labour from his brow and looking pleased with himself. The headman of the village then stepped up to speak, and people began to shift and stir. I stretched as unobtrusively as possible, wondering what there might be for supper. Distracted by these musings, I didn't at first notice that the shiftings and stirrings were becoming more pronounced. Then the woman beside me straightened up abruptly and said something loud, in a tone of command. She cocked her head to one side, listening. The headman stopped talking at once, and all around me people began to look upward. Bodies grew rigid and eyes grew wide. I heard it too, and a sudden shiver raised goose flesh on my forearms. The air was filled with a rush of wings. "What on earth is that?" Brianna whispered to me, looking upward like everyone else. "The descent of the Holy Ghost?" I had no idea, but it was getting louder, much louder. The air was beginning to vibrate, and the noise was like a long, continuous roll of thunder. "Tiskwa!" shouted a man in the crowd, and all of a sudden there was a stampede for the door. Rushing out of the house, I thought at first that a storm had come suddenly upon us. The sky was dark, the air filled with thunder, and a strange dim light flickered over everything. But there was no moisture in the air, and a peculiar smell filled my nose. Not rain. Definitely not rain. "Birds! My God, it's birds!" I barely heard Brianna behind me among the chorus of amazement all around. Everyone stood in the street looking up. Several children, frightened by the noise and darkness, started to cry. It was unnerving. I had never seen anything like it, nor had most of the Cherokee, judging from their reaction. It felt as though the ground was shaking. The air was certainly shaking, vibrating to the clap of wings like a drum being slapped with frantic hands. I could feel the pulse of it on my skin, and the cloth of my kerchief tugged, wanting to rise on the wind. The paralysis of the crowd didn't last long. There were shouts here and there, and all of a sudden people were rushing up and down the street, charging into their houses and racing out again with bows. Within seconds, a perfect hail of arrows was zipping up into the cloud of birds, and feathered bodies plopped out of the sky to land in limp, blood-soaked blobs pierced with arrows. Bodies weren't the only thing plopping out of the sky. A juicy dropping struck my shoulder, and I could see a rain of falling particles, a noxious precipitation from the thundering flock overhead, raising tiny puffs of dust from the street as the dropping struck. Down feathers shed from the passing birds floated in the air like dandelion seeds, and here and there larger feathers, knocked from tails and wings, spiralled down like miniature lances, bobbing in the wind. I hastily backed up, taking shelter under the eaves of a house with Brianna and Jemmy. We watched from our refuge in awe as the villagers jostled each other in the street, archers shooting as fast as they could, one arrow following on the heels of another. Jamie, Peter Bewley and Josiah had all run for their guns and were among the crowd blasting away, not even troubling to aim. It wasn't necessary. No one could miss. Children streaked with bird droppings dodged and darted through the crowd, picking up the fallen birds, piling them in heaps by the doorsteps of the houses. It must have lasted for nearly half an hour. We crouched under the eaves, half deafened by the noise, hypnotized by the unceasing rush overhead. After the first fright, Jemmy stopped crying, but huddled close in his mother's arms, head buried under the drape of her kerchief. It was impossible to make out individual birds in that violent cascade. It was no more than a river of feathers that filled the sky from one side to the other. Above the thunder of the wings, I could hear the birds calling to each other, a constant susurrus of sound like a windstorm rushing through the forest. At last, at long last, the great flock passed, stray birds trailing from the ragged fringe of it as it crossed the mountain and disappeared. The village sighed as one. I saw people rubbing at their ears, trying to get rid of the clap and echo of the flight. In the midst of the crowd, Jackson Jolly stood beaming, liberally plastered with down feathers and bird droppings, eyes glowing. He spread out his arms and said something, and the people nearby murmured in response. "We are blessed," Satsawi's sister translated for me, looking deeply impressed. She nodded at Jamie and the Beardsley twins. "The ancient white has sent us a great sign. They will find the evil bear, surely." I nodded, still feeling slightly stunned. Beside me, Brianna stooped and picked up a dead bird, holding it by the slender arrow that had pierced it through. It was a plump thing, and very pretty, with a delicate, smoky blue head and buff-coloured breast feathers, the wing plumage a soft reddish-brown. The head lolled limp, the eyes covered by fragile, wrinkled grey-blue lids. "It is, isn't it?" she said softly. "I think it must be," I answered, just as softly. Gingerly, I put out a finger and touched the smooth plumage. As signs and portents went, I was unsure whether this one was a good omen or not. I'd never seen one before, but I was quite sure that the bird I touched was a passenger pigeon. The hunter set forth before dawn the next day. Brianna parted reluctantly from Jemmy, but swung up into her saddle with a lightness that made me think she wouldn't pine for him while hunting. As for Jemmy himself, he was much too absorbed in rifling the baskets under the bed platform to take much notice of his mother's leaving. The women spent the day in plucking, roasting, smoking, and preserving the pigeons with wood ash. The air was filled with drifting down, and the scent of grilled pigeon livers was thick in the air as the whole village gorged on this delicacy. For my part, I helped with the pigeons, interspersing this work with entertaining conversation and profitable barter, only pausing now and then to look toward the mountain where the hunters had gone, and say a brief silent prayer for their well-being and Roger's. I had brought 25 gallons of honey with me, as well as some of the imported European herbs and seeds from Wilmington. Trade was brisk, and by the evening I had exchanged my stocks for quantities of wild ginseng, cohosh, and, a real rarity, a chagas. This item, a huge warty fungus that grows from ancient birch trees, had a reputation, or so I was told, for the cure of cancer, tuberculosis, and ulcers. A useful item for any physician to have on hand, I thought. As for the honey, I had traded that straight across for 25 gallons of sunflower oil. This was provided in bulging skin bags, which were piled up under the eaves of the house where we were staying, like a small heap of cannonballs. I paused to look at them with satisfaction whenever I went outside, envisioning the soft, fragrant soap to be made from the oil. No more hands reeking of dead pig fat. And with luck, I could sell the bulk of it for a high enough price to make up the next chunk of Lyra's blood money, damn her eyes. The next day was spent in the orchards with my hostess, another of Tsatsawi's sisters, named Sungi. A tall, sweet-faced woman of 30 or so, she had a few words of English, but some of her friends had slightly more, and a good thing, my own Cherokee being so far limited to hello, good, and more. In spite of the Indian lady's increased fluency, I had some difficulty in making out exactly what Sungi meant. Depending upon whom I was talking to, it seemed to mean either onion, mint, or, confusingly, mink. After a certain amount of crosstalk and sorting out, I got it established that the word seemed to mean none of these things precisely, but rather to indicate a strong scent of some kind. The apple trees in the orchard were young, still slender, but bearing decently, providing a small yellowish-green fruit that wouldn't have impressed Luther Burbank, but which did have a nice crunchy texture and a tart flavour, an excellent antidote to the greasy taste of pigeon livers. "It was a dry year," Sungi said, frowning critically at the trees. "Not so much fruit as the year before, and the corn was not so good either." Sungi put her two young daughters in charge of Jemmy, obviously warning them to be careful, with much pointing toward the wood. "Is good the bear killer come," she said, turning back to me, apple basket on her hip. "This bear, not bear, is not speak us."
"Oh, ah," I said, nodding intelligently.
One of the other ladies helpfully amplified this idea, explaining that a reasonable bear would pay attention to the shaman's invocation, which called upon the bear spirit, so that hunters and bears would meet appropriately. Given the colour of this bear, as well as its stubborn and malicious behaviour, it was apparent that it wasn't a real bear, but rather some malign spirit that had decided to manifest itself as a bear. "Ah," I said, somewhat more intelligently. "Jackson mentioned the ancient white. Was it the bear he meant?" Surely Peter had said that white was one of the favourable colours, though. Another lady, who had given me her English name of Anna, rather than try to explain what her Cherokee name meant, laughed in shock at that. "No, no, ancient white, he the fire." Other ladies chipping in here. I finally gathered that the fire, while obviously powerful and to be treated with deep respect, was a beneficial entity. Thus, the atrociousness of the bear's conduct. White animals normally were accorded respect and considered to be carriers of messages from the other world. Here, one or two of the ladies glanced sideways at me. But this bear wasn't behaving in any manner they understood. Knowing what I did about the bear's assistants from Josiah Beardsley and the wee black devil, I could well understand this. I didn't want to implicate Josiah, but I mentioned that I had heard stories, carefully not saying where I had heard them, of a black man in the forest who did evil things. Had they heard of this? Oh, yes, they assured me, but I shouldn't be troubled. There was a small group of the black men who lived over there, nodding toward the far side of the village and the invisible canebrake and bottomlands beyond the river. It was possible that these persons were demons, particularly since they came from the west. It was possible that they were not. Some of the village hunters had found them and followed them carefully for several days, watching to see what they did. The hunters reported that the black men lived wretchedly, having barely scraps of clothing and without decent houses. This seemed not how self-respecting demons should live. However, they were too few and too poor to be worth raiding, and the hunters said there were only three women, and those very ugly, and they might be demons after all. So the villagers were content to leave them alone, for now. The black men never came near the village, one lady added, wrinkling her nose. The dogs would smell them. Conversation lapsed then as we spread out through the orchard, gathering ripe fruit from the trees, while the younger girls gathered the windfalls from the ground. We went home in mid-afternoon, tired, sunburnt, and smelling of apples, to find that the hunters had come back.
4 possums, 18 rabbits, and 9 squirrels, Jamie reported, sponging his face and hands with a damp cloth. We found a great many birds, too, but what with the pigeons we didn't bother, save for a nice hawk that George just wanted for the feathers.
He was windblown, the bridge of his nose burned red, but very cheerful.
And Brianna, bless her, killed a fine elk just the other side of the river. A chest shot, but she brought it down, and cut the throat herself, though that's a dicey thing to do when the beast's still thrashing.
Oh, good, I said, rather faintly, envisioning a flurry of sharp hooves and lethal antlers in the close vicinity of my daughter.
Dinna fash yourself, Sassenach, he said, seeing my expression. Our daughter the proper way of it. She came from behind.
Oh, good, I said, a little more tartly. I imagine the hunters were impressed.
Very much, he said cheerfully. Did you ken, Sassenach, that the Cherokee let their women make war as well as hunt? Not that they do it so often, he added, but now and again one will take it into her head and go out as what they call a war woman. The men will follow her, in fact.
Very interesting, I said, trying to ignore the vision this summoned up of Brianna being invited to head up a Cherokee raiding party.
Blood will out, I suppose. What?
Never mind. Did you happen to see any bears? Or were you too busy exchanging interesting tidbits of anthropological lore? He narrowed one eye at me over the towel with which he was wiping his face, but answered equably enough.
We found a deal of bear sign. Josiah's an eye for it. Not only the droppings. He spotted a scratching tree, one with bits of hair caught in the bark. He says that a bear has a favourite tree or two and will come back to the same one again and again. So if you're set to kill a particular bear, you could do worse than camp nearby and wait.
I gather that strategy didn't answer at present.
I dare say it would, he answered, grinning. Save it was the wrong bear. The hair on the tree was dark brown, not white.
The expedition hadn't, however, been a failure. The hunters had completed a great semicircle round the village, casting far out into the wood, then ranging down as far as the river. And in the soft earth of the bottom land near the canebrake, they had found footprints.
Josiah said they were different from the prints of the bear whose hair we found, and Satsawi thought they were the same as the prints he'd seen when the white bear killed his friend.
The logical conclusion, agreed upon by all the bear experts present, was that the ghost bear had, in all probability, made its den in the canebrake. Such places were dense, dark and cool in the heat of summer, and teeming with birds and small game. Even deer would hide there in hot weather.
"You can't get into such a place on horseback, can you?" I asked.
He shook his head, combing leaves out of his hair with his fingers.
"No, nor can you make much headway on foot, either, dense as it is. but we didna mean to go in there after the bear.
Instead, the plan was to set fire to the canebrake, driving the bear, and any other game present, out onto the flat bottom land on the other side, where it could be easily killed. Evidently, this was common practice in hunting, particularly in the fall, when the canebrakes grew dry and flammable. However, the burning would likely drive out a good deal more game than only the bear. That being so, an invitation had been sent to another village, some 20 miles distant, for their hunters to come and join with those of Ravenstown. With luck, enough game would be taken to supply both villages for the winter, and the extra hunters would ensure that the evil ghost bear didn't escape. "Very efficient," I said, amused. "I hope they don't smoke out the slaves, too."
"What?"
He paused in his tidying. "Black devils," I said, "or something along those lines." I told him what I had learned about the settlement, if that's what it was, of escaped slaves, if that's what they were.
"Well, I dinna suppose they're demons," he said dryly, sitting down in front of me so that I could braid his hair up neatly into a queue. "But I shouldn't have think they'll be in danger. They must live on the far side of the canebrake, on the opposite bank of the river. I'll ask, though. There's time. It'll be 3 or 4 days before the hunters come back from Kangalai."
"Oh, good," I said, tying the thong neatly in a bow. "That will give you just about time enough to eat all the leftover pigeon livers."
The next few days passed pleasantly, though with a sense of rising anticipation that culminated with the arrival of the hunters from Kongolai, Briartown, or so I was told.
I wondered whether they'd been invited because of a particular expertise in dealing with thorny territory, but forbore asking. Jamie, with his usual sponge-like facility, was picking up Cherokee words like headlice, but I didn't want to tax his ability with trying to translate puns just yet. Jemmy appeared to have inherited his grandfather's touch with languages, and in the week since our arrival had roughly doubled his vocabulary, with half his words being now in English and the other half in Cherokee, which rendered him unintelligible to everyone except his mother. My own vocabulary had been expanded by the addition of the words for water, fire, food, and help. For the rest, I depended on the kindness of the English-speaking Cherokee. After the proper ceremonies and a large welcoming feast, featuring smoked pigeon livers with fried apples, the large party of hunters set off at dawn, equipped with pine torches and firepots, in addition to bows, muskets, and rifles. Having seen them off with a suitable breakfast, cornmeal mush mixed with pigeon livers and fresh apples, those of us not in the hunting party repaired to the houses to pass the time in basketry, sewing, and talk. The day was hot, muggy, and still. Not a breeze stirred in the fields, where the dry stalks of harvested corn and sunflowers lay like scattered pick-up sticks. No breath of air moved the dust in the village street. If one was going to set something on fire, I thought, it was a good day for the job. For myself, I was pleased to take refuge in the cool, shadowy interior of Sungi's cabin. In the course of the day's conversation, I thought to ask about the components of the amulet that Nyawene had made for me. Granted, she had been a Tuscaroran medicine woman, so the underlying beliefs might not be the same. But I was curious about the bat.
"There is a story about bats," Sungi began,
and I hid a smile. The Cherokee were, in fact, a great deal like the Scottish Highlanders, particularly in terms of liking stories. I had heard several already in the few days we had spent in the village.
"The animals and the birds decided to play a ball game," Anna said, translating smoothly as Sungi talked. "At this time, bats walked on 4 feet like the other animals. But when they came to play in the ball game, the other animals said no, they couldn't play. They were too small and would surely be crushed. The bats didn't like this."
Sungi frowned with a grimace indicating a displeased bat.
"So the bats went to the birds and offered to play on their side instead. The birds accepted this offer, and so they took leaves and sticks
and they made wings for the bats. The birds won the ball game, and the bats liked their wings so much that...
Sungi stopped talking abruptly. Her head lifted, and she sniffed the air.
All around us, the women stopped talking. Sungi rose swiftly and went to the door, hand braced on the doorframe as she looked out.
I could smell the smoke. Had been smelling it for the last hour as it came floating in on the wind. But I realized that the reek of burning had indeed gotten much stronger now.
Sungi stepped outside. I got up and followed her with the other women, small prickles of unease beginning to nip at the backs of my knees.
The sky was beginning to darken with rain clouds, but the cloud of smoke was darker still, a roiling black smudge that rose above the distant trees. A wind had come up, riding on the edge of the approaching storm, and flurries of dry leaves rolled past us with a sound like small skittering feet.
Most languages have a few monosyllables suitable for use in situations of sudden dismay, and so does Cherokee.
Sungi said something I didn't catch, but the meaning was clear. One of the younger women licked her finger and held it up, but the gesture was unnecessary. I could feel the wind on my face strong enough to lift the hair from my shoulders, cool on my neck. It was blowing straight toward the village.
Anna drew a long, deep breath.
I could see her inflate herself, shoulder squaring to deal with the situation. Then all at once the women were in motion, hurrying down the street toward their houses, calling for children, stopping to sweep the contents of a rack of drying jerky into a skirt, or snatch a string of onions or squash from the eaves in passing. I wasn't sure where Jemmy was. One of the older Indian girls had taken him to play with. But in the flurry, I couldn't be sure which one it was. I picked up my skirts and hurried down the street, ducking into each house without invitation, looking for him. There was a strong feeling of urgency in the air, but not panic. The sound of the dry leaves seemed constant, though, a faint rustling that followed at my heels. I found him in the fifth house, sound asleep, with several other children of different ages, all nestled like puppies in the folds of a buffalo robe. I would never have spotted him, save for his bright hair shining like a beacon in the midst of the soft darkness. I woke them as gently as possible and extricated Jimmy. He came awake at once, though, and was looking round, blinking in confusion.
"Come with Granny, sweetheart," I said. "We're going to go now."
"Corsey?"
he asked, brightening at once. "An excellent idea," I replied, hoisting him onto one hip. "Let's go find the horsey, shall we?"
The smell of smoke was much stronger when we emerged into the street. Jemmy coughed, and I could taste something acrid and bitter at the back of my mouth as I breathed. The evacuation was in full progress. People, mostly women, were hurrying in and out of the houses, pushing children before them, carrying hastily wrapped bundles of belongings. Still, there was no sense of panic or alarm in the exodus. Everyone seemed concerned, but fairly matter-of-fact about it all. It occurred to me that a wooden village located in a deep forest must now and then be exposed to the risk of fire. No doubt the inhabitants had faced at least the possibility of a forest fire before, and were prepared to deal with it. That realization calmed me a little, though the further realization that the constant dry leaf rustling that I was hearing was, in fact, the crackle of the approaching fire, wasn't calming at all. Most of the horses had gone with the hunters. When I reached the brush pen, there were only three left. One of the older men of the village was mounted on one, and had Judas and the other horse on tethers, ready to lead away. Judas was saddled and wore his saddlebags and a rope halter. When the old man saw me, he grinned and called something, gesturing to Judas.
"Thank you," I called back.
The man leaned down and scooped Jemmy deftly from my arms, allowing me to mount Judas and get proper hold of the reins before handing Jemmy carefully back. The horses were all restless, stamping and shifting. They knew as well as we did what fire was, and liked it even less. I took a firm hold on the halter with one hand, and a firmer hold on Jemmy with the other.
"Right, beast," I said to Judas with an assumption of authority.
"We're going now." Judas was all in favour of this suggestion. He headed for the open gap in the brush fence as though it were the finish line of a race, snagging my skirts on the thorns of the fence as we passed. I managed to hold him back a little, long enough for the old man and his two horses to emerge from the brushy paddock and catch us up. The man shouted something to me and pointed toward the mountain, away from the fire. The wind had picked up. It blew his long grey hair across his face, muffling his words. He shook it away, but didn't bother to repeat himself, instead merely wheeling his mount in the direction he had pointed. I kneed Judas in the side, turning him to follow, but kept a close rein, hesitating. I looked back over my shoulder toward the village to see small streams of people trickling out from between the houses, all heading in the general direction the old man had indicated. No one was running, though they were all walking with great purpose. Bree would be coming for Jamie as soon as she realized that the village was in danger. I knew she trusted me to see him safe, but no mother in such circumstances would rest until reunited with her child. We weren't in any immediate peril, so I held back, waiting, in spite of Judas's increasing agitation. The wind was lashing through the trees now, ripping loose billows of green and red and yellow leaves that pelted past us, plastering my skirt and Judas's hide in autumn patchwork. The whole sky had gone violet black, and I heard the first grumbles of thunder under the whistle of wind and rustle of fire. I could smell the tang of coming rain, even through the smoke, and felt a sudden hope. A good hard drench seemed just what the situation called for, and the sooner the better. Jemmy was wildly excited by the atmospherics, and beat his fat little hands on the pommel, shouting a personal war chant toward the heavens that sounded something like, "Oogie, oogie, oogie." Judas didn't care for this sort of behaviour at all. I was having an increasingly hard time keeping him under any sort of control. He kept jerking at the halter while executing a sort of corkscrew manoeuvre that carried us in erratic circles. The wrapped rope was cutting hard into my hand, and Jemmy's bare heels were drumming a tattoo against my thighs. I had just decided to give up and let the horse have his head, when he suddenly swung round and flung the head in question up, neighing loudly toward the village. Sure enough, there were riders coming. I saw several horses coming out of the forest on the far side of the village at a trot. Judas, overjoyed to see other horses, was more than willing to go back into the village, even though it was in the direction of the fire. I met Brianna and Jamie in the middle of the village, both looking anxiously round as they rode down the street. Jamie shrieked with delight at the sight of his mother and lunged across into her arms, narrowly missing being dropped under the horse's nervous hooves. "Did you get the bear?" I called to Jamie. "No!" he shouted back over the rising wind. "Come away, Sassenach!" Bree was already off, heading for the forest where the last of the villagers were disappearing into the trees. Relieved of my responsibility for Jemmy, though, I thought of something else. "Just a minute!" I shouted. I pulled up and slid off Judas's back, throwing the reins toward Jamie. He leaned out to catch them and yelled something after me, but I didn't catch it. We were outside Sungi's house, and I'd caught sight of the skins of sunflower oil piled under the eaves. I risked a glance back in the direction of the canebrake. The fire was definitely coming closer. There were visible wisps of smoke swirling past me, and I thought I could see the glimmer of distant flame among the lashing trees. Still, I was fairly sure that we could outrun the fire on horseback, and that was a year's honey profit lying about on the ground. I wasn't leaving it for the fire to take. I dashed into the house, ignoring Jamie's infuriated bellows, and scrabbled madly through the scattered baskets, hoping against hope that Sungi hadn't taken... She hadn't. I seized a handful of rawhide strips and ran back outside. Kneeling amid the swirling dust and smoke, I whipped strips of hide around the necks of two of the skin bags and knotted the long ends of the two strips together, pulling the leather as tight as I could. Gathering the unwieldy pair up into my arms, I staggered back to the horses. Jamie, seeing what I was about, gathered both sets of reins up one-handed, leaned out, and grabbed the makeshift handle that joined the skins, heaving the contraption over Gideon's withers so that the bags hung on either side. "Come on," he shouted. "One more?" I called back, already running back to the house. From the corner of my eye I could see him fighting the horses who were plunging and snorting, anxious to be away. He was yelling uncomplimentary things about me in Gaelic, but I sensed a certain resignation in his tone, and couldn't help smiling to myself in spite of the anxiety that tightened my chest and made me fumble with the slippery hide strips. Judas was snorting and rolling his eyes, baring his teeth intermittently with fear, but Jamie pulled him up close, holding his head tightly while I managed to fling the second pair of oil-filled bags across his saddle and then mount myself. The moment Jamie's iron grip on his halter relaxed, Judas was off. The rope was in my hands, but realizing its uselessness, I merely clung to the saddle for dear life, the oil bags bouncing madly against my legs as we high-tailed it for the safety of the rising ground.
This ends Disc 34. The Fiery Cross, Disc 35.
The storm was a lot closer now. The wind had dropped, but the thunder sounded in a loud clap overhead, which made Judas dig in his heels and bound over the open ground like a jackrabbit. Judas hated thunder. Remembering what had happened the last time I'd ridden him in a rainstorm, I flattened myself along his back and clung like a cocklebur, grimly determined not to be thrown or scraped off in his mad career. Then we were into the wood, and leafless branches lashed at me like whips. I pressed myself lower against the horse's neck, closing my eyes to avoid having one poked out. Judas was moving more slowly now, by necessity, but was clearly still panicked. I could feel the churn of his hindquarters driving us upward and hear the breath whistling through his nostrils. The thunder came again, and he lost his footing on the slippery leaves, slewing sideways and smashing into a stand of saplings. The springy wood saved us major damage, though, and we stumbled and staggered back upright, still moving upward. Opening one eye cautiously, I could tell that Judas had somehow found a trail. I could see the faint line of it zigging through the dense growth in front of us. Then the trees closed in again, and I could see nothing but a claustrophobic array of interwoven trunks and branches, twined with the yellowing remnants of wild honeysuckle and the flash of scarlet creepers. The thick growth slowed the horse still further, and I was at last able to draw a deep breath and wonder where Jamie was. The thunder cracked again, and in its wake I heard a high-pitched neigh not far behind me. Of course, Judas hated thunder, but Gideon hated to follow another horse. He would be close behind, pushing to catch up. A heavy drop of rain struck me between the shoulder blades, and I heard the rustle of the beginning rain striking drop by drop by drop on leaves and wood and ground around me. The scent of ozone was sharp in my nostrils, and the whole wood seemed to give a green sigh, opening itself to the rain. I gave a deep sigh, too, of relief. Judas took a few steps further and lurched to a halt, panting and blowing. Not waiting for another clap of thunder to set him off again, I hastily slid to the ground and, seizing his halter rope, tied him to a small tree, no easy task with my hands stiff and shaking. Just in time, the thunder crashed again, a clap so loud that I could feel it on my skin. Judas screamed and reared, jerking at his rope, but I'd wrapped it round the tree trunk. I stumbled back to get away from his panic, and Jamie caught me from behind. He started to say something, but the thunder boomed again, drowning him out. I turned and clung to him, shaking with the adrenaline of delayed shock. The rain began to fall in good earnest now, drops cool on my face. He kissed my forehead, then let go, and led me under the overhang of a big hemlock whose fans of needles broke the rain, providing a fragrant, almost dry cave beneath. As the adrenaline surging through my body began to die down, I had a moment to look around and realized that we were not the first inhabitants of this refuge. "Look," I said, pointing into the shadows. The traces were slight but obvious. Someone had eaten here, discarding a tidy pile of small bones. Animals weren't so tidy. Animals didn't scrape up dead needles into a comfy pillow either. Jamie winced at another bang of thunder, but but nodded. "Aye, it's a man-killer sport, though I dunno think it's been used lately."
"A what?"
"Man-killer," he repeated.
The lightning flashed behind him, a vivid sheet that left his silhouette imprinted on my retina.
"It's what they call the sentries. The warriors who stay outside the village to keep watch and stop anyone coming in unaware. Do you see?"
"I can't see a thing just yet." I put out a hand, groping, and touched his coat sleeve, moving blindly into the shelter of his arm. I closed my eyes in hopes of restoring my vision, but even against my sealed lids I could see the flash and burst of lightning. The thunder seemed to be moving off a little, or at least growing less frequent. I blinked and found that I could see again. Jamie moved aside, gesturing, and I saw that we were standing on a sort of ledge with the face of the mountain rising steeply behind us. Screened from view from below by a row of conifers, there was a narrow clearing, obviously man-made, as that was the only sort of clearing that occurred in these mountains. Looking out through the conifer branches, though, I had a breathtaking view over the small valley where Ravenstown lay. The rain had slackened. Looking out from this high vantage point, though, I could see that the clouds were not one storm, but several. Patches of dark rain hung randomly from the clouds like veils of grey velvet, and silent, jagged forks of lightning lanced suddenly across the black sky above the distant peaks, thunder grumbling in their wake. Smoke still bloomed from the canebrake, a low, flat crown of pale grey, almost white against the darkened sky. Even as high as we were, the smell of burning stung the nose, mingling oddly with the scent of rain. Here and there I could see flame licks still burning in the cane, but it was apparent that the fire was mostly out. The next shower of rain would quench it entirely. I could see, too, the people returning to the village, small groups making their way from the woods, bundles and children in tow. I looked for riders, but saw none, let alone any with red hair. Surely Brianna and Jemmy were safe, though. I shivered suddenly. With the changeableness of mountain weather, the air had gone from smothering blanket to chill within less than an hour. "All right, Sassenach." Jamie's hand settled warmly on my neck, fingers rubbing gently along the tense ridge of my shoulders. I took a deep breath and let them relax as much as I could. "Yes. Do you think it's safe to ride down?" My only impression of the trail was that it was both narrow and steep. It would be muddy now, and slippery with wet, dead leaves. "No," he said, "but I dinna think..." He stopped abruptly, frowning in thought as he gauged the sky. He glanced behind us. I could barely make out the outline of the horses standing close together under the shelter of the tree where I had tied Judas.
"I was going to say, I didna think it particularly safe to stay here," he said at last.
His fingers tapped gently on my shoulder as he thought, pattering like raindrops.
"But yon storm is moving fast. You can see the lightning come across the mountain and the thunder."
With melodramatic timing, a sharp boom of thunder rolled across the valley. I heard a shrill whinny of protest from one of the horses and the rattle of foliage as he tugged at his halter. Jamie glanced over his shoulder, expression bleak.
"Your mount's got a strong mislike of thunder, Sassenach."
"Yes, I noticed that," I said, huddling closer to him for warmth. The wind was picking up again as the next storm rolled in.
"Aye, he'll likely break his neck and yours too if you're so misfortunate as to be on that trail when it..."
Another boom of thunder drowned his words, but I took his meaning.
"We'll wait," he said positively.
He pulled me in front of him and put his arms round me, sighing as he rested his chin on the top of my head. We stood together in the shelter of the hemlock, waiting for the storm to come. Far below, the canebrake seethed and hissed, the smoke of the burning beginning to rise and fly with the wind. Away from the village this time, toward the river. I wondered suddenly
where Roger was. Somewhere under that murky sky. Had he found safe refuge from the storm? I wonder where that bear is, too, I said, voicing half my thoughts. Jamie's chest moved in a rueful laugh, but the thunder drowned his voice. Chapter 83 Wildfire. Roger half woke with the smell of smoke burning in his throat. He coughed and sank back into sleep, fragmented images of a sooty hearth and burnt sausages fading into mist. Tired from a morning of shoving his way through impenetrable thickets of brush and cane, he had eaten a sparse lunch and lain down for an hour's rest in the shade of a black willow on the river bank. Lulled by the rushing water, he might have sunk back into solid slumber, but a distant shriek pulled him upright, blinking. The shriek was repeated, far off but loud. The mule! He was on his feet, stumbling toward the sound, before he remembered the leather bag that held his ink and quills, the half-chain, and the precious surveying records. He lunged back to snatch it, then splashed across the shallows toward Clarence's hysterical braying, the weight of the astrolabe swinging on its thong against his chest. He crammed it inside his shirt to stop it catching on branches, looking desperately for the way by which he'd come. Smoke. He did smell smoke. He coughed, half choking as he tried to stifle it. Coughing hurt his throat with a searing pain as the scar tissue inside seemed to tear. Coming, he breathed in Clarence's direction. It wouldn't have mattered if he could have shouted, even when he'd had a voice. It hadn't the carrying quality of Clarence's. He'd left the mule hobbled in a grassy patch on the edge of the canebrake, but he hadn't come in very far. Again, he muttered, throwing his weight against a stand of young cane to force his way through. Yell again, damn it. The sky was dark. Springing from sleep and blundering off as he had, he'd no sense of where he was, save for Clarence. Shit, what was happening? The smell of smoke was noticeably stronger. As his mind cleared from the muddle of sleep and panic, he realized that something was drastically wrong. The birds, normally somnolent in midday, were agitated, fluttering and calling with loud disjointed screeches past his head. Air moved restlessly through the canes, fluttering their ragged leaves, and he caught a touch of warmth on his face. Not the moist, clinging, all-embracing warmth of the muggy canebrake, but a dry, hot touch that brushed his cheek and sent a paradoxical chill right down his back. Holy Christ, the place was on fire! He took a deep breath, calming himself deliberately. The canebrake was alive around him. A hot wind was moving, rattling dry canes, driving flocks of songbirds and parakeets before it, flung like hands full of bright confetti through the leaves. The smoke crept into his chest and gripped his lungs, burning, keeping him from drawing a full breath. Clarence! He rasped, as loudly as he could. No good. He could scarcely hear himself above the rising agitation of the canebrake. He couldn't hear the mule at all. Surely the fat-headed animal hadn't been burned to a crisp already. No, more likely he'd broken his rag hobbles and galloped off to safety. Something brushed his leg, and he looked down in time to see the naked, scaly tail of a possum scampering into the brush. That was as good a direction as any, he thought, and plunged into the growth of button bush after it. There was a grunting somewhere near. A small pig burst out of a patch of yorpon and crossed his path, heading to the left. Pig, possum, was either known to have a good sense of direction. He hesitated for a moment, then followed the pig. It was big enough to help break a path. A path there seemed to be. Small patches of bare earth showed here and there, trampled between the tussocks of grass. Wild orchids winked among them, vivid as small jewels, and he wondered at the delicacy of them. How could he notice such things at such a time? The smoke was thicker. He had to stop and cough, bending nearly double and clutching at his throat, as though he could keep the tissue intact, keep from tearing with his hands. Eyes streaming, he straightened up to find the trail had disappeared. A thrill of panic squeezed his insides as he saw a wisp of drifting smoke nosing its way slowly through the undergrowth, delicately questing.